taking a fresh towel with him. He returned to the study. Now he retrieved his raincoat and put it on. This would cover the blood on his clothes. Then he grabbed his briefcase, wiped it down, and pulled out the digital recorder. He pushed stop to end the recording, and plugged earbuds in to listen in privacy. It took a moment of rewinding to find where he had exploded at the president and FSB chief. This part, and everything that followed, he erased. Then he rewound to the beginning, yanked out his earbuds, set the device on the desk, and pressed play, turning up the volume so that it would sound, from the hallway anyway, like people were still talking in the study. He looked around one last time to make sure he hadn't left anything behind. He hadn't. But he suddenly remembered one more element of Marcus's instructions. He pulled out his personal mobile phone and sent a one-word text to a Russian mobile number Marcus had given him. Хорошо. Хорошо in Russian meant good. He put on his leather gloves and scarf and walked out the door of the study, through the short hallway, out the second door, and into the care of an armed escort ready to take him to his helicopter. No one hovering around the door struck Alec as suspicious. But as they walked briskly to the helipad, his thoughts turned to Katya Slatsky. She was going to be furious to be leaving the palace with him and not her lover. He was going to need to say something to calm her down, and Marcus had given him nothing. He'd only insisted Alec find a way to keep her away from Luganov, lest she find his body before his detail, and scuttle any chance, however small, of a safe escape. Yet Katya was the least of his problems. When he reached the north entrance, Alec realized that he had completely forgotten about the fact that he would be assigned a new security detail. Apparently Marcus had, too. Now 6 large and well-armed men were waiting to board the helicopter with him and Katya for the short hop to the airport.
"Commander, I need you and your team to meet me at the airport," Alec told the head of the detail over the whining rotors. "The president has an important message he needs me to share with Miss Slatsky. I'm afraid it's of a very sensitive personal nature, and we need to be alone."
"That would be highly irregular, sir, especially after what happened to you this morning," the agent shouted back.
"These are the express orders of the president," Alec replied. "But you'll never make it in time on the roads. Order another chopper, and I'll wait for you there. And don't worry, I'll be fine."
Alec did not wait for an answer. He pulled the side door of the helicopter shut, locked it, and ordered the pilot to take off for Domodedovo immediately. The pilot did as he was told. Katya, however, erupted with a torrent of profanity.
"Quiet, quiet, please, Katya. I have good news," Alec told her. "I'm sorry you're feeling hurt, and that we had to move so quickly. I truly am. Please know that. But the president cannot be disturbed by anyone right now for reasons that you'll understand very soon, I promise."
"But I keep calling him and he doesn't answer," she cried, her mascara running.
"He can't. Not right now. But I have to tell you something very important."
"What?"
she pressed.
"What is it?"
Alec took a deep breath, pulled off his gloves, and took her shivering hands in his own, leaning close to her ear.
"The president, I can't believe I'm telling you this. He swore me to secrecy. But I just have to tell you."
"What is it, Alex Stefanovich? Stop torturing me."
"Okay, I will,"
he said, and he leaned in even closer.
"The president,"
he took a deep breath,
"is about to propose to you."
Katya's eyes went wide.
"It's true," Alec assured her. "He showed me the engagement ring he bought for you. It's enormous, gorgeous."
"Are you serious? Alexander Ivanovich is really going to ask me to marry him?"
"I think it might even be tonight," Alec added. "He didn't tell me where or how, but I got the impression it just might be tonight."
Katya squealed with delight.
"I beg of you, please don't tell him I told you," Alec pleaded. but I could see how upset you were. I didn't want you to think ill of the president. He has so many burdens on him right now. But he needs you to know he loves you, and that you'll never be parted."
Katya couldn't speak. She was overwhelmed with emotion, and collapsed into Alek's arms, weeping with joy and tremendous relief. 93. Domodedovo International Airport, Moscow, September 29th. The G4 had to be de-iced again. That took another 20 minutes. The temperature was dropping, and visibility was poor and worsening with the driving snow. Then Alec's text came in, and everything changed. "It's him," Marcus said, staring at the screen of the mobile phone. "And?" Morris asked, double-checking the gauges on the console one more time. "He's on his way." Morris looked up at her partner. She was still angry with him. He could only imagine what she'd be like if she knew the whole story.
"You'd better go," she said. "I'll make sure everything's ready."
"Thanks," he said to her. "For everything."
"We're not out of the woods yet, Riker. Put on your headset and don't get caught."
She handed him a whisper mic and an earpiece, which he put on at once. She did the same. They tested them with a few sentences each. Then Marcus chambered around in his pistol, put the gun in the holster under his jacket, and unlocked the cockpit door. He opened the cabin door and lowered the steps, and he was off. Marcus headed straight across the tarmac for the airport security car the agents had left him. Only then did he remember that the car hadn't been brushed off since they'd boarded the plane. It took several minutes to wipe everything down, especially the headlights, and several more to chip a layer of ice off the driver's side lock. It took longer for the engine to turn over and warm up. But once he had it running, he jacked up the heat and the windshield wipers and unzipped the canvas bag on the passenger side floor.
"Operations to Post One. Operations to Post One. Come in. Over."
"Post One, copy. Over,"
Special Agent Pavel Kovalyov replied.
"We have a problem,"
said the watch officer in the operations command post, located in the basement of the presidential palace.
"Well, a possible problem."
"Roger that, Ops. What's wrong?"
"I just noticed that the drapes in the president's study are drawn."
"And?"
"Well, sir, I've never seen that done in the 3 years I've been doing this job,"
said the watch officer.
"The drapes are supposed to remain open at all times so we can keep an eye on the president and make sure everything's all right."
"We're having a very private discussion, Ops,"
Kovalyov replied.
"The president doesn't want any disturbances or distractions until he leaves for the Kremlin."
"Affirmative, Post One. But the drapes are supposed to remain open for his protection."
"Are you saying there's a problem?"
"That's just it, sir. How would I know?"
"What was happening inside the study before the drapes were closed?"
"We're re-racking the video now. The problem is, with all the snow, the condensation on the window and the glare, the images aren't clear. Everything's hazy."
"Switch to thermal."
"Doing that now."
"And?"
There was a long pause. Too long for Kovalyov.
"What is it, Ops?" he pressed. "What can you see?"
"Code red! Code red!"
shouted the watch officer, the horror in his voice palpable, broadcasting on the emergency frequency for every agent in the compound to hear.
"Go in now! I repeat, go in now!"
The submachine gun was loaded and instantly accessible. Relieved, Marcus swept on the orange flashing safety light on the roof and began to proceed toward his target. The airport maintenance team was doing a decent job keeping the runways plowed. This was Moscow, after all. They had plenty of experience with snow. Still, for whatever reason, the access lanes for baggage carts, fuel trucks, and other vehicles like his were taking longer. Fishtailing his way across the airport grounds, Marcus worried he might hit something or someone in the rapidly dropping visibility. When he finally reached the helipad, it was empty. A ground crew was waiting. That was a hopeful sign, suggesting something was inbound. But there was no chopper visible, and Marcus's stomach tightened. He began counting to 50, but heard the roar. Then he saw it, descending rapidly from the thick cloud cover amid a swirling, billowing spray of snow and ice. Marcus positioned the security car as close to the helipad as he safely could, so Alec wouldn't have to be exposed to the elements for a single second longer than necessary. He reached over and unlocked the passenger door. Then he stepped out of the car and into the bitter, whipping winds. As the chopper door opened, Marcus came around the car and stood by the passenger door, ready to open it the moment Alec emerged. But Alec didn't emerge. Not right away, and not for several minutes. "We may have a problem," he radioed Morris.
"What is it?"
"The chopper door is open, but the Raven has not emerged."
"How long?"
"Too long. I'm going to check it out."
"Copy that. What do you need from me?"
"Just make sure we're ready to get off the ground the second we get back." Marcus strode to the door of the chopper, unbuttoned his overcoat as he did to make it easier to grab his pistol if he had to. He had to. Just before he reached the door, a gun went off inside the helicopter, blowing out a window. Marcus heard a woman screaming and a fight break out on board. Gun drawn, he raced up the steps, only to find the co-pilot and Alec wrestling in the tight confines of the cabin. Marcus didn't think twice. He double-tapped the co-pilot, then pivoted and double-tapped the pilot. A woman, wrapped in a black cashmere coat and furs, was screaming hysterically. Marcus had never seen her before, but she posed no threat. He grabbed Alec by the collar and hauled him off the chopper without saying a word. Throwing him in the back seat of the waiting car, Marcus slammed the door shut, then got behind the wheel and peeled off across the tarmac.
"They know! They know!"
Alec began yelling the second they were alone.
"I don't know how, but they know."
94. Alec was hyperventilating and risked going into shock. But there was nothing Marcus could do about it. It didn't matter how the FSB knew or how Alec had managed to avoid being handcuffed or shot inside that chopper. Their only chance of survival was to get back to Morris and off the ground. Even then, he doubted they had better than a 1 in 10 chance of making it out of Russian airspace without being shot down by MiGs, assuming they could even get away from Domodedovo in one piece. As he radioed back to Morris that they were inbound, Marcus could hear sirens converging from the north and the west. Then he noted the police band radio set where the AM-FM system usually was. He switched it on, and the radio crackled to life. Marcus couldn't understand a word of Russian, but he instantly recognized both the fear and the urgency in their voices.
"What are they saying?" he shouted to Alec in the back seat.
"They just issued my death sentence," Alec said.
"What?"
"The dispatcher is telling every police officer and security guard in or near the airport grounds that I'm responsible for assassinating the President of the Russian Federation and the head of the FSB," said Alec. "The security services are unleashing everything they have to hunt me down, along with anyone helping me. Shoot to kill. No mercy."
Marcus switched off the security car's flashing light, and then for good measure, cut the headlights too. Given the dimness and swirling snow, he hoped that would lower their profile, making them nearly invisible. Whoever was hunting Alec was headed to the helipad. The ground crew at the helipad had surely seen him pull Alec off the chopper and into this car. But if the car was invisible, they still had a chance. It wasn't much to go on, but that measure of confusion might buy them the time they needed. Just then, Marcus spotted a police car, red and blue lights flashing, siren blaring, racing straight toward them. He slowed a bit and veered right out of the patrol car's path, hoping it would blow right past them. Instead, the driver hit the brakes and tried to follow them, but hit an ice patch and spun out of control. Marcus accelerated, zigzagging dangerously through planes and food service trucks.
"They've spotted us," Alec said, continuing to translate what he was hearing over the police band radio. "An officer is giving a description and our heading."
"What else?"
Now they say I'm with one suspect, armed and dangerous, and that we're heading toward the private aviation terminal.
Well, they had that right, Marcus thought, as he spotted the G4. Then Alec pointed out two more patrol cars converging on them. The one behind them was coming up fast. We're going to be at the plane in about 15 seconds, Marcus said calmly. When we get there, I want you to bolt out the right side. You hear?
Yes.
Get up the stairs and into the plane as fast as you can.
What about you? Alec asked.
I'll cover you. The second you get on that plane, hit the deck.
What does that mean?
Get on the floor and stay there.
Okay.
Tell the pilot to pull up the stairs, taxi, and take off.
What if you're not on board yet?
I'll be there.
But if you're not?
Then I'm not coming. Marcus tapped the brakes and skidded to a stop in front of the G4. Grabbing the machine gun and kicking open the driver's side door, he looked back at Alec and shouted,
"Run!"
All three police cruisers tried to brake. One slid right past them and smashed into the side of the terminal. The other stopped more successfully, within 20 yards of them. Marcus pivoted into the snow and opened fire. Alec watched him for a moment, then jumped out and raced up the steps of the Gulfstream, while a hail of bullets erupted all around him. Marcus kept firing in short bursts as he moved around the hood of the car. When he saw he'd clipped the officer firing from beside the wrecked cruiser, he popped out a spent magazine and reloaded. Then he opened fire again, still in short bursts, as he crouched low and worked his way backward up the steps. Rounds pinged off the metal stairs and the fuselage. Then someone opened fire from just over his right shoulder. He glanced around and saw Morris.
"Get in," she yelled. "I've got you."
Marcus turned and scrambled up the last few stairs as Morris hit the switch and the stairs folded into the plane. Together, they shut and locked the door behind them and headed for their respective seats in the cockpit.
"Take a seat and buckle in,"
Marcus shouted to Alec as Morris revved the engines and began taxiing away from the terminal.
"Recline the seat all the way, and whatever you do, keep your head down and don't look out the window."
Suddenly, rounds began hitting the side of the plane again. From his vantage point, Marcus couldn't see who was firing, but he urged Morris to push the engines harder and stay out of the taxi lanes. This wasn't a normal takeoff. These were combat conditions, and they needed to get this thing in the air before more police cars arrived and blocked their exit, or shot out their tires or their windows. Morris did what he told her, but said nothing. Marcus craned his neck to one side and then the other, scanning for threats. When he turned back to her, he saw her wince, then saw blood all over her jacket and shirt. 95. "You're hit," he said calmly.
"I'm fine, Riker,"
Morris replied just as calmly.
"We'll deal with it in the air."
But she wasn't merely wincing now. She could barely sit upright.
"You're not fine," he said. Never mind me," she gasped. "Do your job."
She was having trouble breathing as well. "You're not going to be able to get us off the ground," Marcus said.
"I have to,
but you can't, so tell me what to do." Morris tried to protest, but she couldn't get the words out. "Conserve your energy," he told her. "Lean back, point to things. Use as few words as possible. I'll get us up." Finally, she nodded, and Marcus took the controls. She walked him through everything, even as she began coughing up blood. Ground control was ordering them to stop. Marcus could see flashing lights coming from all directions. The G4 was approaching the first possible runway, but the ground lights were all red, indicating they had to stop for an aircraft either about to take off or land. Marcus looked to his left and saw no plane on the runway. He looked right and saw nothing on the ground. But there were lights in the sky at 2 o'clock. The sirens were getting louder, which meant they were getting closer. Alec began shouting that the police cars heading toward them were being joined by armored personnel carriers with 50-caliber mounted machine guns. That was it. They were out of time. He couldn't wait any longer. Marcus increased speed, and eased the G-4 out onto the runway, turning right toward the approaching plane.
No,
Morris groaned.
You can't.
Marcus didn't respond.
You're insane,
she said, almost in a whisper.
Stop.
But Marcus wasn't listening. He checked the flaps. They were at the zero position. Preparing for a short takeoff, he throttled forward to full power while pressing hard on the brakes. The high-pitched whine of the dual Rolls-Royce engines filled the cockpit. Then he released the brakes. They all snapped back in their seats as the Gulfstream began hurtling down the runway. The Aeroflot jumbo jet was dead ahead of them, less than a mile out, on approach for the runway they were on, and putting down its landing gear.
You're gonna get us all killed!
Alec screamed, watching what was happening through the open cockpit door. Marcus didn't respond. They were committed now. He was trying desperately to keep the plane centered on the runway with the rudder pedals, but with so little experience flying, and none in a business jet, they were veering to the right, then lurching back to the left. They were in danger of sliding off the icy runway, but they were picking up speed. There was a chain-link fence at the end of the 10,000-foot strip. It was covered in snow and ice, but it was coming up fast. Panicked, Morris briefly took the pedals. She re-centered the jet and ordered Marcus to increase flaps to takeoff position. The moment he did, they reached 150 miles an hour.
Now!
She yelled. Marcus pulled back on the yoke. The instant their wheels were off the ground, he abandoned gentility and pulled harder, creating a far steeper angle for takeoff. The ground controllers were cursing at him. They were heading straight into the Aeroflot, but Marcus refused to change course. Alarms sounded in the G-4 cockpit. Caution, obstacle, caution, obstacle. The Russian plane, filled with hundreds of passengers, was coming directly at them. Despite the storm, Marcus could actually see the pilots in their cockpit, frantically waving them off. He could hear them yelling at him over the radio. Yet he kept increasing speed. He was not going to divert. Too much was at stake. They had to gain speed and altitude if they had any chance of survival, even if that meant playing chicken with a jumbo jet. At the last second, the Aeroflot banked hard to the right, retracted its landing gear, and boosted power. The G-4 surged by, clearing the Russian jet by less than 50 yards. Marcus raised his landing gear and pulled the Gulfstream into the clouds and the freak storm bearing down on Moscow. Morris was ashen, but both she and Alec were quiet. The immediate danger had passed, but each of them knew what lay ahead. "Where's the transponder?" Marcus asked, as they passed 2,000 feet.
"Why?"
Morris asked, her voice thin and raspy. "I'm going to turn it off," he said. "We've got to go dark." Morris looked at him like he needed to be institutionalized. Marcus didn't care. He proceeded to turn off all the external lights and all the cabin and cockpit lights as well. Only the glow of the instrumentation remained. Relenting, Morris pointed to the transponder switch in the lower right section of the center console, then used hand gestures to indicate he should turn it 3 clicks to the left. Marcus did, and their digital signature, the communication system telling air traffic controllers precisely who they were and where they were at any given moment, shut down. The G-4 would still show up as a blip on radar, of course. But now, they were an unidentified blip. That certainly didn't make them impossible to track or intercept, but it made it harder. Marcus asked Alec to come up to the cockpit and help get Jenny into one of the seats in the back. Shaken, but eager to assist, Alec responded immediately. "They teach you any first aid in the Army?" Marcus asked.
"A little."
"Then take care of my friend. We need to get her home in one piece." Alec nodded and was about to leave when Marcus grabbed him by the arm.
"One more thing," he said.
Marcus motioned for him to come in very close, so Morris couldn't hear them.
"She doesn't know what you just did, and she's in no shape to hear it now," he whispered. "Understood?"
Alec nodded, a bit confused, perhaps, on how it was possible that Marcus's partner didn't know all the details. Nevertheless, while Marcus kept flying the plane, Alec unbuckled Morris and carefully carried her out, apologizing profusely for the discomfort he was causing her. Soon they reached a cruising altitude of 43,000 feet. They were racing for international airspace at a speed of nearly 500 knots, about 575 miles per hour. Marcus engaged the autopilot. According to the extraction plan he and Morris had mapped out, they were headed for Helsinki. This was just 893 kilometers away. They'd already been in the air for 12 minutes. They had another 50 to go. Marcus knew they'd never make it that far. Defense Minister Mikhail Petrovsky was headed back to the war room when the call came. He'd only gotten 3 hours of sleep, but at least he had been in his own bed. As his driver sped along Leninsky Avenue, parallel with the Moskva River, headed toward the center of the city, one of his bodyguards took a secure call from Nikolai Kropotkin, the deputy director of the FSB. He handed the phone to his boss.
"Kropotkin, he says it's urgent."
Petrovsky sighed and took another sip of black coffee from his travel mug before taking the call. When everything was urgent, was anything?
"Yes, Nikolai Vladimirovich. I have the revised estimates with me," he said in exasperation. "Tell the president I will transmit them the moment I get into the office."
"No, sir, that's not why I'm calling."
"Then why?"
"Where are you?"
4 minutes out. Can it wait?"
"No, it cannot," Kropotkin said. "Brace yourself, Mikhail Borisovich."
"Whatever for?"
"The president, sir."
"What about him?"
"I'm afraid he's dead."
"What? That's impossible."
"I just got off the phone with the palace. Alexander Ivanovich is dead, as is Dmitri Mitrovich."
"Both of them,"
Petrovsky said, sitting bolt upright in the back seat of the bulletproof sedan, its flashing blue lights, and those of the security cars flanking them, illuminating his face in the stormy darkness.
"When? How?"
"It was Alek Stefanovich. He shot them both at point-blank range,"
Kropotkin replied breathlessly.
"They were alone in the president's study. It all happened so quickly. But it appears that he had help. He got to the airport, Domodedovo, where someone was waiting with a private plane."
"Tell me the police stopped him."
"There was a shootout, but Alek was able to get on board a jet and take off. We were tracking it, but they turned off their transponder, and for the moment we've lost it."
Petrovsky cursed, and then ordered the deputy to scramble a dozen MiGs, find the jet, and take it down.
"Right away, sir,"
Kropotkin said.
"I'll give you an update when you arrive. But that's not all."
"Go on."
"You need to convene the cabinet. We are about to go to war. The country does not have a president, but we desperately need one. And with all due respect, sir, it should be you."
96. The White House Situation Room, Washington, D.C., September 29th.
"We have confirmation, Mr. President."
Bill McDermott handed Clark a printout of a text he'd just received from the Magic Palace. The Gulfstream was safely off the ground. The Raven was on it. The agency's people had the thumb drive in their possession, and its contents had been electronically uploaded to the CIA's mainframe computers. Their analysts were already starting to break down the data. The president nodded approvingly. It was the first piece of good news he'd seen in days. But he was still furious with his NSC team.
"Why hasn't the hotline call with Luganov been set up?" he demanded.
McDermott said he didn't know what the delay was. Officials in the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon said the problem wasn't on their end. Their counterparts in Moscow were dragging their feet. and it was not yet clear why. Marcus unbuckled his seatbelt and headed to the cabin. His first priority was to check on Morris. She'd been hit in the right shoulder, Alec said, and the wound was quite serious. Alec was doing his best to patch her up. He'd put her in his own seat, which he had fully reclined. He'd managed to finally staunch the bleeding, using every cloth he could find on board, from towels to pillowcases. He'd given her several shots of morphine to manage the pain. Then he'd covered her with a blanket, and was now telling her stories of his childhood to distract her from how much trouble she was in. Not bad for a government lackey, Marcus said, as he dabbed the perspiration off her face with a washcloth and wiped several strands of hair out of her eyes. He leaned close to her cheek and whispered, "You're going to be okay. I'm going to make sure of it." Morris tried to smile. It was more of a grimace, but it would do. Marcus excused himself and went into the restroom. He was no longer wearing the disguise he'd put on at the Ramada. He'd taken that off when he changed into the co-pilot's uniform. Still, as he looked at his unshaven face in the mirror, he wasn't happy with what he saw. The disguise was gone. The pain was not. He was suddenly hit with a wave of despair. He desperately missed Elena. Closing his eyes, he could still see her sitting in Mr. Grantham's English class back in the 6th grade. They'd only been 11. They'd gotten married when in their early 20s. Now he was approaching his 40s, alone. His hair was going gray at the temples. He had crow's feet around his bloodshot, exhausted eyes. He had scrapes and bruises all over his body. And for all his morning runs and evenings at the gym, he'd been surprised how quickly he'd been winded tonight. Then again, this little team had made it farther than he'd really thought possible. It was only by the grace of God, he knew, not by any skill of his own. That said, what was next? Was the Lord really going to bring them this far, only to let them be blown out of the sky? He reached into his pocket and pulled out the thumb drive Alec had given him. He stared at it, wondering what treasures it contained. He hoped this had all been worth it. Only time would tell the full value to the American government, and perhaps to NATO, should the Clark team choose to share any of the fruit of their classified labors. But the mission had cost more than Marcus had wanted to pay. He wasn't morally opposed to killing bad guys, especially to protect the people and country he loved. But killing anyone took its toll. Would it stop the war? He prayed it would. Then again, he knew only too well that if his and Jenny's involvement with Alec were discovered, that information alone could trigger a war with Russia anyway. And what if they did die tonight, shot down by an air-to-air missile? It was an ugly thought, but a real and rapidly growing possibility, even probability. He wasn't scared. He knew where he was going when he died. He was pretty sure Jenny was a follower of Christ as well. He would have loved time to talk faith and so many other things with her. But what about Alec? What would happen to him? Marcus suddenly realized that in everything that had transpired, he'd never thought once about Alec's soul. Did the man know the Savior? Had he given his life to Christ? Were his sins forgiven? Had he ever even heard the gospel clearly explained to him? Marcus couldn't remember thinking about such things in the Marines or the Secret Service. He'd done his job, and done it to the best of his ability. He'd never second-guessed the morality of the mission. The Taliban were sheer evil. Al-Qaeda was worse. Each person he took out had been a clean kill, casualties of a military conflict. Marcus was more than willing to give up his own life to protect his country and her leaders. But the deaths of his wife and son had changed everything. Studying with Pastor Emerson and the vets on Wednesdays back in Lincoln Park had changed him too. These days he thought a great deal about eternity. Why then had he not thought of Alec's fate? He felt uncertain and ashamed. Petrovsky got more bad news the moment he arrived at the Defense Ministry. The Air Force had been scrambled, but the plane carrying Alek Stefanovich still had not been found. There were just too many planes in the sky at the moment. Too much clutter and confusion over Moscow and the western skies. It was like finding a needle in a haystack, he was told. He went ballistic.
"Get every plane on the ground, now," he ordered.
He turned on every TV in his office. Fortunately, news of the assassinations had not yet broken. A quick check of multiple channels confirmed that, but Petrovsky knew the story would not hold for long. He had already called Luganov's chief of staff and persuaded him to summon the entire cabinet for an emergency meeting at the Kremlin, without giving any hint as to the reason. At the same time, he knew Kropotkin, now operating as acting director of the FSB, had made it crystal clear to his men that anyone who leaked this news would be guilty of treason and would be executed without a trial. The one person he worried about most was Katya Slatsky, who had been taken to the Kremlin after the debacle at the airport. She had to be isolated indefinitely. If there was one person who could leak the whole thing prematurely and not care in the slightest about the implications, it was she. Petrovsky thus ordered Kropotkin to send someone to Luganov's private chambers at the Kremlin, drug her, and keep her drugged until they could figure out exactly what to do with her. Kropotkin didn't flinch, but vowed to carry out the orders at once. Meanwhile, Petrovsky issued written orders for all Russian military forces to cease their exercises and begin withdrawing from the borders of the Baltics and Ukraine. To the outside world, such actions would look entirely consistent with what Luganov had been saying publicly. The inner circle of high government officials, he knew, might believe Petrovsky had orchestrated a coup d'etat to stop a war they knew he did not support. He did it anyway. The hours ahead would be chaotic enough. There was no guarantee he would wind up at the top of the Kremlin's greasy pole. But if there was anything he could do while still alive and in power to defuse the prospect of nuclear war with NATO, he was bound and determined to do it. 97. Russian airspace, September 29th.
"It's time," Marcus said.
He explained to Morris and Alek exactly what was happening and how little time they had to decide their fate. As he did, the Gulfstream hit a bit of turbulence. The plane shook for a few moments, worrying an already rattled Alek, then stabilized again. Just then, Marcus's sat phone rang. He answered it, gave a 9-digit code proving his identity, listened carefully, acknowledged the message, and hung up. He raced back to the cockpit. Seconds later, a series of alarms started sounding and lights began flashing. These had nothing to do with the standard avionics package. The plane's sophisticated radar system had been installed by technicians at Langley. It was not unlike the ones used by American fighter jets and even Air Force One. From the back, Alek shouted a message from Jenny.
"Turn off the autopilot."
Marcus did, then flicked a series of other switches, and a new radar display flickered to life. Gone were the weather data and the images of the massive snowstorm hitting the northwestern provinces of Russia. Now he was staring at a display showing two blips 40 miles back and gaining fast.
"What's that?"
Alek demanded, suddenly standing behind Marcus.
"Go finish getting her ready," Marcus replied.
He didn't have time for explanations. Reluctantly, Alek agreed. The moment he left, Marcus closed the cockpit door. The blips were MiGs. The Global Operations Center at Langley had just called to alert him that they'd intercepted a series of Russian civilian and military communications. On the civilian side, the Kremlin had issued a full ground stop on all flights preparing to take off throughout the Russian Federation. They were requiring all air traffic over the country to land immediately at the nearest airport. On the military side, Russian fighter squadrons throughout the Western Military District were being scrambled and directed to hunt and shoot down any Gulfstream business jets of any description. The Magic Palace had not indicated that the fighter pilots or their weapons systems officers had been given a specific tail number. They had, however, been authorized to use any means necessary to prevent any business jets from leaving Russian airspace. Marcus was surprised the Russians had taken this long to issue such an order. He chalked it up to the fog of war and the interruption in the chain of command Alec had created by taking out the president and the FSB chief. But none of that mattered. Whatever delay there had been, it was over now. The MiGs were up and in hot pursuit. He turned the yoke, banking the plane to the north, off the flight plan and away from St. Petersburg, and beyond it, Helsinki. There was no way he was going to let the Russians force them to land. He and Morris had discussed this in depth when they'd been planning Alec's extraction. If they were shot down, so be it. But under no circumstances could they let themselves or this plane and its contents be taken intact. The fighter jets were now only 32 miles behind. No sooner had Marcus turned off and reset the alarms than they sounded again. He looked again to the enhanced radar screen and saw two more MiGs coming up from a base just south of St. Petersburg. These were only 20 miles out. When the alarms blared yet again, he spotted two more MiGs converging on them from the north, less than 15 miles out. So that was that. They had no fewer than 6 fighter jets streaking toward them, with orders to keep them from reaching international airspace at all costs. And then the radio began to squawk. The first message came from St. Petersburg Air Traffic Control. It was directed to all civilian flights, informing them that Russian airspace was now closed and ordering them to land immediately. Marcus was struck by the fact that Langley had gotten that message to them faster than the Russians themselves. Moments later came the second message from the lead pilot of one of the Russian fighter jets. He spoke firmly in clear, if heavily accented, English. Obey his orders and follow him to the nearest Air Force base, or be fired upon. Marcus didn't hesitate. He took the controls, picked up the intercom, and ordered Alec and Jenny to cinch their seatbelts as tight as they could. Then he pushed the yoke forward and began a brutally steep dive. It took mere seconds to plunge from 43,000 feet to only 20,000 feet, and Marcus found his stomach in his throat. The G-forces threatened to knock him out, but he hadn't lost the MiGs. They were screaming in from every direction, and as he leveled out the G-4, now around 18,000 feet, he knew they were going to be fired on at any moment. Marcus decreased speed and once again turned on the autopilot. Then he unbuckled himself and left the cockpit. "You ready?" he asked. They both nodded.
"As we'll ever be,"
Morris managed to say, brave to the last. Bill McDermott sat in the Situation Room next to the president. Like his colleagues and Clark himself, he had tried to hold out hope for his friend and the team he had with him, though he knew it was futile. Now that they'd been found, now that both the Kremlin and the White House were tracking the G-4 in real time, there was no way Marcus, Morris, and the Raven were ever going to shake the MiGs. To the contrary, they were about to be blown to kingdom come. McDermott's eyes were glued to the flat-screen monitors, and he couldn't look away. The largest monitor, the one mounted on the far wall directly across from the commander-in-chief, showed the live radar tracking of 6 fighter planes converging on the Gulf Stream. Various digital displays along the bottom of the screen provided rapidly changing data from each of the 7 aircraft: altitude, airspeed, direction, and so forth. McDermott had been stunned by the G-4's harrowing 25,000-foot plunge, but he was even more disturbed by the bizarre decision to level off at 18,000 feet and slow down. Yes, the plane was smack dab in the middle of a thick band of clouds, but it wasn't going to matter. It wasn't going to hide them or make them any less vulnerable. Marcus and Morris certainly knew that. So why weren't they still diving? The Gulfstream wasn't a fighter jet. It wasn't built to withstand the extreme pressures of dogfighting. But by diving for St. Petersburg, not banking away from it, and flying low across the deck, they might buy enough time to figure out a way to get out into neutral territory over the Gulf of Finland. However crazy the Russians were, they certainly weren't going to shoot a G-4 out of the sky over one of their most populous cities. Yet the radar track showed none of the moves McDermott would have made in Marcus's place. Then again, McDermott knew Marcus had never flown a jet. He'd flown Piper Cubs in his 20s, so he was at the mercy of the CIA's Moscow station chief. Jennifer Morris was brilliant and highly respected throughout the intelligence community, and she'd helped Marcus pull off one of the greatest intelligence coups in the history of the agency. Still, maybe she hadn't been ready for what came next. He couldn't say for sure, but one thing he knew. Jenny Morris was about to get his friend, and the best Marine he'd ever had the honor to command, killed. The Situation Room was silent. The Pentagon wasn't feeding them live audio of the Russian pilots, nor were they getting any communications from the G-4. No one gathered around the conference table and staring at the screen spellbound was saying anything. Not the president. Not the generals. What was there to say? Then McDermott saw it. He grabbed one of the remotes off the table in front of him and zoomed in on the image. American radar was picking up an air-to-air missile being fired by the lead MiG-29, followed almost instantaneously by a second one. It took only the blink of an eye, and the G-4 disappeared from the screen. Everyone knew what had happened. Yet McDermott couldn't believe it. He kept staring at the screen in silence, as the MiGs turned in pairs, presumably returning to their base. Then, out of nowhere, the Pentagon patched through the intercepted audio of the Russian pilots after all. They were whooping and hollering and congratulating one another, as were their base controllers, and surely their superiors in Moscow. And Bill McDermott just sat there, staring at the flickering screen, aghast. The missiles had come quick. The resulting fireball had been as blinding as it had been enormous. But as Marcus hurtled downward through the thick clouds and frigid night sky, free-falling at terminal velocity with an unopened parachute strapped to his back, Jenny Morris strapped to his front, and Alec in a separate parachute a few yards to his right, he didn't feel scared. He wasn't thinking about the rest of the escape or the aftermath of the tensions between Russia and the West. Nor was he thinking about Elena or Lars, or about his mother, or the Garcias, or any of his Marine buddies, much less the rest of his life. There'd be plenty of time to think about such things soon enough. Right now, in the silence, save the steady hiss of the oxygen flowing into his helmet, a single thought kept echoing in his brain. It wasn't from Dostoevsky or Solzhenitsyn. It wasn't from his mom, or even from the scriptures. It was from Churchill, and for Marcus, it captured the moment perfectly. There truly was nothing more exhilarating than being shot at with no result. Epilogue. The White House Situation Room, Washington, D.C., September 29th. McDermott's phone rang. He instantly recognized the number. It was Nick Vanetti in Moscow. He took a deep breath and answered in a hushed tone so as not to distract the president, who was huddled in the corner with the defense secretary and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, discussing their next moves. Nick was calling from the operations center underneath the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. "You with the president?" he asked, his voice more stressed than sad.
"Yeah,"
McDermott said.
You calling about Marcus?
No, actually.
No? There's something else, something bigger,
Vanetti said.
What are you talking about?
Bill, something's about to break here, and you need to let the president know before he hears it from anyone else.
Then spit it out,
McDermott ordered.
What's wrong?
It's President Luganov.
What about him?
He's been assassinated.
What?
It's not just him. Dmitry Nimkov, too.
That's not possible,
McDermott said.
It's true, and there's more,
Vanetti said.
I'm listening.
The guy you just put on that plane to whisk out of Moscow, the Raven, that's the guy the Russians say pulled the trigger. McDermott felt the blood drain from his face. He didn't know if this meant the war was still coming or not. What he did know was that the world had just changed. Again. And he had to tell the president. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Kremlin Conspiracy by Joel C. Rosenberg, performed by Adam Gruber. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brilliancaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.